obvious, simple level of Torah learning, bringing you to know the details of what to do, there is a second level. The second level is that Barasi Yetzer Hara, Barasi Torah Tavla. The Rabban Hashem says, I created the Yetzer Hara, and I created the Torah as a spice to the Yetzer Hara, an antidote. The Torah enables you to even use your Yetzer Hara in service of God. It channels everything for the good. But without the Torah, a person is prey to his Yetzer Hara, to his evil inclination. And being prey to your evil inclination prevents you from doing mitzvahs and enables you to do aveiros. When a person doesn't have a protection, doesn't have an antidote, something to counteract his Yetzer Hara, his evil inclination, he's going to end up doing aveiros. So Torah learning helps a person to control his Yetzer Hara and therefore not do aveiros and to do mitzvahs. So Gedola Talmud Torah Shemivia Lidei Maisa. By learning Torah, it will lead you to do the mitzvahs. Not because it will teach you what to do, but it will enable you what to do. Because even if you know what to do, you may not do it because your Yetzer Hara prevents you from doing it. Or urges you to do what's wrong. But by learning Torah, you control the Yetzer Hara. So that is another aspect of how Torah learning brings you to do mitzvahs. But there's even a third, deeper level. And that is, it says that the Satan, the Sorosh al Esav, Esav's guardian angel, who is the Satan, came to fight with Yaakov Avinu. So the Svarim ask, why didn't he fight with Avram and Yitzchak? He was around in their time too. Avram Avinu represented Chesed. Why wasn't he upset by the chesed of Avram Avinu and fight with him? Yitzchak Avinu represented Avoda, right? Tefillah, Korbanos. Why wasn't he upset with that? Why didn't he fight against Yitzchak? Why only Yaakov Avinu? So they say, Rabbi Chavetz Chaim, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, two ideas. One is that without Torah, Chesed and Avoda can be totally distorted. That Torah puts everything into the proper perspective. And it enables you to do things in the proper way. Because if you don't have Torah, you can totally distort mitzvahs and do them in a way that are the opposite of what their intention was. Okay? For instance, a person may realize that he has to honor his parents. So as honoring his parents, he's going to listen to them to do things against the Torah, which is not only prohibited, right? Parents say, cook me a steak on Shabbos. You're not allowed to listen to them. Not only you don't have to listen to them, you're not allowed. And if you do it, you're mechalel Shabbos. And not only that, but you are promoting and giving your parents something negative. So not only aren't you honoring them, even though they think it's an honor for you to do what you're doing, but you're harming them. Because they then are an accomplice to your Avera. You're doing the Avera because of them. And even though you shouldn't have done it, and they're not going to be responsible for making you do it because you should have not listened to them, but Lamaisa, the reason you did is because of them, they're involved. So somehow it's going to affect them in a negative way. In fact, the fact that they have a child who's Mechalel Shabbos. So if you don't learn Torah, you can do mitzvahs in a distorted way and end up doing things that are wrong, thinking they're right. The chesed can become Gili Arayis, doing chesed. Right? Can become immorality. But you're doing it because you want to do people chesed. You want to be Makar of them. Right, so you end up doing things that are promiscuous and immoral and for the sake of kiruv. That's not chesed. That's something that's wrong. But if you don't learn Torah, you won't know that. And the same thing goes with avoda. Avoda can be avoda zora. I want to serve God, right? But it could be that your service of the Rabbanu Shalom is in itself an avoda zora. It's a strange service. It's not what the Rabbanu Shalom wants. Doing things that are totally wrong. And therefore, the Tzar Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Chaim Mordechai Katz Zatzal, said that when we say in the morning, Elu dvorim, shadam ochel peiroseim b'olam hazev, akeren kayemes olam haba. These are the things that a person eats the fruits of in this world, and the major principle is rewarded in the world to come. And it mentions a whole list of things: kibud avo gemilus chasodim v'hashkamas beisem midrash shachris v'arvis v'achnosus kala v'achnosus orchimu v'ikur cholim v'halvayas ameis. All these chesed. It ends with Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Simple meaning, and Talmud Torah is equal to all of them. He says it means something else, in addition to what it really means. He said it also means a follower. Before you can do any of these things, visit the sick and comfort the mourners, and be machnis kala, you need to take Talmud Torah and put it opposite all of these things and view these things through the lens of Torah. You have to put Torah opposite it and view it through the lens of Torah to know if you're in fact doing a mitzvah. Is this really Bikur Cholim? Is visiting this sick person the way that you're doing it proper? Is this really Kibud Avoim and Gemilus Chasodim? Is this really a chesed? Are you doing person a chesed or not? Without analyzing everything through the light of Torah, putting Torah opposite it, and analyzing it through the light of Torah, you're not going to know if all these things are being done properly or not. So that's another idea of Talmud Torah keneged kulam. And therefore, gedola Talmud shemivili demaisa. It's not only that without learning you won't know the details of what to do. It's not only that without learning you won't have the motivation to do because you'll have a yetzer hara. But even if you'll have the motivation, and you'll know, but you won't do it properly. You'll do it in a distorted way if you don't know Torah and are able to evaluate what is proper and what's not proper, what's distorted and what's not distorted. And therefore, the Satan didn't bother with Avraham Avinu. Chesed, you want to do chesed, gesunter hate. Without Torah, chesed could serve the Satan. Because you can do chesed in a way that will be distorted and be really evil, even though you think you're doing somebody a kindness, but it comes out that kindness comes out to be evil. Very simple example, right? Maybe you don't need too much Talmud Torah to know about, but it applies to more subtle things. Somebody's a drug addict, and they ask you for money so they can feed their habit. Now you think you're doing chesed. You're helping this person. You're not helping them at all. You're hurting them. The biggest chesed would be to deny them the money and send them to a drug clinic where they can be detoxified. You want to do chesed? Pay for that. Don't give them money that they're going to go use on drugs and become more addicted. And the same thing goes for much more subtle things. Where you feed a person. I'll give you an example that's not so simple. And that perhaps without learning Torah deeply, or asking someone who's learned Torah and knows what Derech HaTorah is, you loan somebody money. And they are people who habitually borrow money and don't pay it back. And they become dependent on these loans. Because of that, they don't work. They have no responsibility in this world. So you think you're doing them a favor. You're doing them a chesed. You're not. That's no different than the drug addict. You are continuing to addict them to be dependent on other people and to borrow money and not pay it back. What you should do is not loan them that money. Get them a job. Help them establish a business. Make them more. Sometimes it means not helping them and making them reach a point where they don't have bread to eat, and then they have to do something. But where they constantly have, and you're constantly giving them, right, then you are feeding their habit. It's a different kind of habit. That's a lot much more subtle than the drug addict, right, and you need a lot more learning to know when this yes and when this not. when yes to help them or not. But you think you're loaning somebody money. It's a mitzvah. Loan people money. But it depends on the situation. Sometimes loaning somebody money is, or giving them a present is not going to help them. It's going to hurt them. And they don't even know, realize that. So, yeah. That's why it says of Talmud Torah, Keneged Kulam. The more you learn, the more you know, the more you can dissect the issue and see clearly what's really true here. Right? And sometimes you have to go, when there's a doubt, to one side, sometimes you have to go to the other side with a doubt. Right? It's not, nothing in this world is black and white or simple. Nothing. And anyone who thinks that things are black and white and simple probably don't have to worry about mitzvahs and averas, because they have the classification of an idiot, somebody who's totally insane. Anybody who lives in the real world knows that things are very complicated. And because they're very complicated, you can't really come to decisions in very, very... in situations that are not simple, that there's no black and white to them, like the situation I mentioned. How do you know? How do you know what the proper response is? You bring it to somebody who is steeped in Torah and has also some seichel, right? Because they don't necessarily go together, okay? So, and the person with his seichel and his Torah knowledge will be able to guide you. And Baruch Hashem, we have Gedolei Yisrael, and we have Choshuva people that can do that. So if you're not on the level of learning Torah yourself, where you have developed your thought process to think like the Rabbanu Shlom thinks, and that's what we'll get to in a second, so go to somebody who has done that. And that's why we go to Gedolim, not just to find out what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Then you go to anybody who knows Halacha. But you go to them for problems that they will never find in a Shulchan Aruch. What do they know better? Where do they find that in the Gemara? But it says that Divrei Torah, learning Torah, conditions a person to think like God. Because the Torah is God's mind. And the more steeped in Torah you are, the more you know how to think like God thinks. And therefore you approach issues with God's mind. With God's mind. And that is another benefit of Talmud Torah. That you begin to think like the Rabbanu Shlom thinks. That's called Das Torah. That's where we go to Gedolim, right? Because their entire database is Torah. When you have a computer, and in its memory, right, is a lot of Narishkeit, then if you put a problem to that computer, what you're going to get out is based on Narishkeit. But if what's in that computer is what's in the memory bank of that computer, right, is all facts, then you'll get out facts. So if what's in the memory bank of a person is Torah, then he's going to use the Torah as the means to what's it called to analyze the issue in front of him. If what's in his memory bank is other things, he's going to use those other things as the analysis for what's the issue is before him. So somebody whose mind is totally immersed in Torah and has learned Torah for years and years on the deepest level. So even though he never learned about this issue, but his mind, his thought process is all going to be, the source of it's going to be Torah, and the mode is going to be Torah. So therefore, if you're not on that level yourself, right, then go to somebody who is and ask their advice. And that's why we go to Gedolei Yisrael, to ask advice. Because they'll give you how the Torah sees things, not how you see it. And again, yeah, no issue is simple. And there are many, many facets and many possibilities. And no two situations are the same. Anybody who gives everybody who comes to him the same advice, don't go to that person for advice. Because there isn't one advice for everybody. Everybody's different. And the same exact question by two different people, the answer is probably going to be different. To one, the answer will be X, and to the other one, Y, completely opposite answers. That's a godel. Right? Somebody once told me they went with a friend, they both had the same question. They were considering going in together and ask it together, but they decided to go separately. Each one asked a question, and then they compared notes afterwards, and the godel told them the exact opposite. This one he told to do X, and this one he told to do Y. There's no contradiction. This guy was an X person, this person was an Y person. Different people. What was good for this one wasn't good for that one. What was good in this situation, and that's why you can't learn, right? A lot of these svarim that bring down things that this godel said in this case or that, could be that it was specific to that case. You can't learn from that. We don't learn from meisim. Meisim are very nice to entertain. We don't learn from them because it may be that that meisim only applied to that specific situation. And in a different situation, a little bit, you do something else. Right? Nothing is generic. Everything is the way it is, what's it called? You don't go to the doctor, right? And two people have the same pain, and one save money, send one in, the doctor will prescribe for him, and you'll get the same prescription. You know, maybe your pain's coming from somewhere else, right? So therefore, you've got to go to the doctor and be examined too, because it could be the source of your pain, even though it's the same pain. You both have pains in your arm, but one is caused by one thing, and another person is caused by a different thing, and they need completely different treatments. So the same way, when it comes to Das Torah, every single thing depends on the situation, on very, very much the details, and unless somebody's a Navi, he can't give you advice unless he knows all the details about you. He knows who you are, what all the details of the situation is. And if somebody gives you advice and doesn't know you and doesn't know all the details, so then one of two things. Either he's a really great person who everybody knows has Ruach HaKodesh. It's okay. So then you can rely on his Ruach HaKodesh. But if he's not somebody like that, right, then probably the advice is wrong, because it's impossible to give advice without knowing all the details and knowing who you're talking to. And not only that, if a person gives advice and doesn't know all the details and he's not a Navi or really somebody big, then he's not the kind of person you want to ask advice from. So you should realize that. Okay. So that's another idea of Gedola Talmud Shemeviya Lidei Maisa, that Talmud Torah brings to action, because you can't really do actions properly if you don't know what to do, if you don't have the motivation to do it, so you've got to fight your Yetzer Hara and Torah helps you. And even if you have the motivation and you know what to do, you have to know that you're seeing it in an objective way and not distorting it subjectively. So therefore you need Talmud Torah Keneged Kula. You need Talmud Torah to be the lens through which to look at all the things that you do and make sure they're done properly. And if you don't have that lens yourself, go to somebody who has it, and let them look through their lens at your situation. Okay, one more point about Talmud Torah. And that is the Gedola Torah Shemivia Lidei Maisa, Gedola Talmud, learning Torah, brings to action, aside from what we just said, there's one more point. And that is, somebody who, all he knows about tefillin is, God said you should put these little black boxes on, and they're black boxes, and I'm putting them on my head, and I'm doing God's will, which is very nice, and you get a mitzvah for that, is very, very different than someone knows what the black boxes, how they make them, how they're supposed to be made, what they are, right? What's inside them? What is the idea behind them? Right? How serious is the reward for doing it? And how serious is the punishment for not doing it? If you know all of those things, the action that you do is so much more a quality action than somebody just does. I'm not saying that the second person is doing it because he understands it or whatever. No. He's doing it because God said to do it, just like the first person. But in addition to that, he knows the depth and the breadth of what it's all about. his action is a much more quality action than the first person. Right? Somebody who keeps Shabbos and knows all the intricacies of Shabbos and all the ideas behind Shabbos. And when he sings Miros, he knows what they mean and he has intention of what he's saying. Right? And he understands the greatness and the beauty of Shabbos. Just doesn't say, well, Shabbos can't work and I'm not working. So you keep me Shabbos, you'll get rewarded for it. But it's not the same quality mitzvah as somebody who knows what Shabbos is all about. To the point where there's a Sfarno in Parshas Bishalach, which I think every educator should copy and hang on their wall and look at every once in a while. The Sfarno says the following. Moshe Rabbeinu told the Jewish people in God's name that there would be no man on Shabbos, and they shouldn't go out and gather the man. You can't gather man on Shabbos, and there's not going to be any anyway. So there's nothing to gather. Man's not going to fall on Shabbos. And the Jewish people, true to what we are, right, went out Friday night to look for man. Okay. The rabbi says this, and the people do it the opposite. Okay, so the Rabban Hashem gets angry, and he says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Ad ona me antem lishmor torosai umitzvot. How long would you refuse, you, collective you, including Moshe Rabbeinu, how long will you refuse to keep my mitzvahs? So, Rashi there asks the same question, Chazal asks the question, as a Sfarno, but they give different answers. The question is, what did Moshe Rabbeinu do? He told them what they're supposed to do. They didn't listen to him. Why is he implicated in this sin that God says, he should have said, how long will they not keep my mitzvahs? Not you, and include Moshe Rabbeinu. What did he do? Says the Sfarno, even though Moshe Rabbeinu did not go out to look for man, to collect man on Shabbos, so he wasn't part of that sin, he caused them to sin. How did he cause them to sin? Says the Sfarno, you know how he caused them to sin? Because all he told them was, there won't, don't collect man on Shabbos. Okay? When you tell somebody that, what is the natural human reaction, especially by Jews? Right? You say don't, I say yeah. What do you mean don't go collect? Who are you to tell me don't do anything? Right? I'm going to go and see what's going on with the mon. And you told them there won't be any mon on Shabbos. Right? So they were curious. They said, we want to see for ourselves. It's a natural human thing to question authority. Okay. So what should Moshe have done? Had you taught them the depth and breadth of why you can't go and collect man on Shabbos? Why not? What's wrong with it? You would have taught them the laws of Shabbos and taught them that collecting the man may be ma'amir, right? Taking things and collecting them in the place where they grow. When the man grew in the desert, right? That's where it fell. So collecting would be osur, or maybe it was carrying from one domain to another. You weren't allowed to carry them on, or maybe it was considered like separating it from the ground where it grew, where it was situated, which is considered like harvesting. Very different possibilities of what's wrong with collecting mon on Shabbos. Had you taught them the halachas of Shabbos, the depth and the breadth, they would have appreciated, right, what it's all about. Not just, don't do it. Don't do it, people, you say, don't do it. They react the opposite. But to tell them, you can't do this because it's ma'amir, it's motzi, it's, what's it called, it's tolesh. There's halachas of Shabbos. Let's sit down and learn these halachas and see how this fits in to the prohibitions of Shabbos. And that wouldn't have been enough. You told them there won't be any man on Shabbos. You should have told them why there won't be any man on Shabbos. Why God made Shabbos special. What is special about Shabbos? And give them a shiur in the hashkafa of Shabbos. The philosophical, what's it called, value of Shabbos. What it's all about. What does it mean? What are you stating by keeping Shabbos? What are you stating by not keeping Shabbos? Right? The tremendous philosophical and metaphysical ideas behind Shabbos. And he says the third thing too. You should have also told them the tremendous reward that people get for keeping Shabbos and the tremendous punishment people get for not keeping Shabbos. And if you had told them all of that, you told them the halachas of Shabbos, they understood the mechanics, they understood the philosophy, they understood the musar, that's halacha, hashkafa, and musar. And they understood the reward and the punishment, who could not keep Shabbos? Somebody who knows all of that, how can he not keep Shabbos? Somebody who knows all of that, doesn't keep Shabbos, has to be a Rasha. But normal people, if they know all of this, that's the way you have to educate people. Not do this, don't do that. That's good for a 3-year-old. But if you're educating people, you have to, not that, you'll only do it if you understand it. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about appreciating the depth and the breadth of what you're doing. And the more you appreciate it, the more you're going to have the incentive to do it. I'm doing it because God said, but I want to know what he said. There's a nasa, but there's also a nishma. The nasa has to come before the nishma. I'm going to do it whether I understand it, whether I know it's also, I have to do it. But there's also a nishma. Sometimes people forget that there's more to it. God wants you to understand. He wants you to learn. He wants that the action that you do be as quality as possible. And the more you know, the more you're going to be able to do. Because the more you know what the halacha is, what the hashkafa is, what the musar is, right? Why in the world would somebody not want to do it if he knows all of that? Not that you're doing it because you know. You're doing it because God said. But you're doing it when you know makes the doing a lot more quality. A lot more quality. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? In the last week's Sedra, there was the task of the woodcutter who went out on Shabbos, and the answer given is that he wanted to show what the punishment is. Would that incident come under the same criteria?
Yes, if God didn't say that you're not allowed to do it in that situation.
Yes,
he made a mistake. He understood that. Okay, since we have enough time, I'll answer your question. Okay. He made a mistake that many people make, big people, people who could be bigger, and decide that they're going to do something that God doesn't want them to do, but they're doing it for God's sake. And they're going to benefit God from it. Give me an example. Forget about big people. There were people who were relatively knowledgeable in Torah in the beginning of the 1900s in America, the late 1800s, who started the conservative movement in America. It wasn't like the Reform that they just wanted to give up Judaism. It didn't start like that. Okay. It started with what seemed to be something that was L'shem Shamayim. They looked at the American scene and they said, Judaism is dying. Orthodox Judaism can't survive here. The old people who keep Shabbos or whatever are dying and the youth are estranged. It's not going to work. The people in Young Israel said the same thing and they had a different solution. They also made mistakes. In the beginning, the Young Israel movement had dances, mixed dancing, right, for boys and girls to bring them into the shul. And they reasoned they're going to be dancing anyway other places with Goyim, might as well bring them into the shul and dance with Yidden. I'll tell you one second what's wrong with that. But that was a similar thing. We're going to do something wrong, and it's wrong. Mixed dancing is awesome. It's Gili Arayis. It could be the son puts a gun to your head and says, go mixed dancing, you have to be shot rather than do it. Would be. But in any case, whatever, it's wrong. But they did it L'shem Shamayim. The conservative, the leaders of the conservative movement had the same intention. They said, if we don't do something and permit people to drive on Shabbos, because they live out in the suburbs, the shuls are all in the inner city, they're not going to come to shul. So we're not capable yet of building shuls out there, right? But let them drive into shul. Because they're going to drive anyway. So this way at least will impress upon them. So they told people you can drive on Shabbos if you come to shul. Now, if they come to shul, They're not going to want to sit men separate and women separate, right? What kind of a draw is that to the shul? We want them to be able to sit with their families, sit with their wife, even better, sit with somebody else's wife. So we'll draw them to shul by taking down the mechitza and having family seating. And this is the way it went, right? If we just do away with certain things, we're doing it for God's sake, the Yiddishkeit will benefit. Okay, in the end, what came from all of that, right, is assimilation. The next generation weren't conservative, they were pretty much reform. The next generation were either assimilated or worse, they became Balei Tshuva. Right? The parents could put up with the fact that they went off the derech completely and intermarried, but Balei Tshuva, right? So, in any case, so that's what happened. They didn't remain, you know, if you have middle-of-the-road Judaism, if you're in the middle of the road, you usually get hit by a truck. And that's what happened. So you can't either have to be on one side or the other side, and that's what happened. In the end, either they went completely to one side or the other. Some say, well, if there hadn't been that conservative Judaism, many people would have been lost. And a lot of people came back because of that. Eventually, they used that as a stepping stone. It's not an excuse. Why? Because the Chafetz Chaim said, he said two mashalim to bring this out, and then I'll tell you the main thing I wanted to say. He said that they used to think that when a person got frostbite, the first aid for frostbite was rubbing snow on the wound. What idiot would say, wow, it's a good thing for snow, because without snow, where would we be if you got frostbite? Without snow, you wouldn't have got frostbite to begin with. Or the Chafetz Chaim said another marshal. He said he once saw somebody dive into a hole in the ice and save somebody who fell into that hole. And he said, I envy you, you saved somebody's life. He said, don't envy me, I dug the hole. The Chafetz Chaim was once asked by a maskil, a lawyer who was a maskil, who was not from, but he knew the Polish language, and there was a gzeira decree against the Jews from the Polish government, and they had to go to repeal the decree, to beg to repeal the decree. And none of the gedolim knew Polish. So they couldn't communicate with the government leaders. So they had to take this lawyer along who knew Yiddish and who knew Polish, and he was basically a free thinker. He wasn't a frum person. So on the trip, he says to the Chafetz Chaim, where would you religious Jews be without people like us? When you have problems, you have to go speak to the government. We're the ones who know how to converse. Chafetz Chaim looked him straight in the eye and said, without people like you, we wouldn't have the problems to begin with. Because of you, we have the problems. Because of you, we need you to help us. Yeah.
Excuse me, I don't know where you got this business about Young Israel. I've been a member my whole life.
I was a rabbi in Young Israel, so that's even better. Yeah.
Still, there's a certain continuity here. My father was also a member of his whole life. Nothing like that ever happened, so it ended.
Okay, in the early 1900s, 1920s, and 1930s, by the Young Israel dinners, they had mixed dancing.
What?
And in New York, in Cleveland, in New York, it's a fact of history. That's not anything against the Young Israel movement, but it happened. That was the early Young Israel movement. In order to bring the youth back, they made changes in the shul which were good, very good changes. They didn't sell aliyahs and they didn't do anything in the shul which was. But one of the things they did was have mixed dancing in the shul. Right, it's a fact. Anybody here was knows about Young Israel. It's a fact.
It may have happened in certain places.
No, it happened in the major. One second, the Young Israel started in New York. Okay, there were no other places. That was the foundation of Young Israel. In those days, in the 1920s, 1930s, that's when it happened.
Excuse me. Yeah. 1920s and 30s. There also were other places. We were living in Detroit.
Okay.
I was alive in the 1930s, and there was a Young Israel.
Okay, fine. And it could be in Detroit, they didn't do it.
Also.
And it could be the rabbi there didn't allow it. But in the major...
I've never heard of it.
Well, you did. Now you heard of it. Now you can't say you didn't hear of it. Now you did hear of it. Okay. It's, again...
A product of their generation. I promise you. I'm a product of that generation. In Memphis, Tennessee, yes, we had it. A very Orthodox show.
Okay.
With Dan.
Yeah, I'm only 85 years old. I'm not older than you are, so you don't remember.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, in any case. In any
I'm
case.
Younger, but I'm not.
The it unfortunately was a fact of history. The they did it l'shem shamayim, but it was a mistake. Eventually it took a long time, but eventually yes. Eventually it was voted down, right? But it for years and years at the Young Israel National Dinner they had mixed dancing. Okay. Okay. The when I was a rabbi in Young Israel, it wasn't happening anymore.
Even in the 50s.
Well,
right, but it, right. Yeah.
That's
exactly what I said. They said that the youth are being lost. Better to bring them to the shul to dance than they should be dancing with goyim in bars. Okay. There's a difference between letting people meet and dance together. In the Upper West Side, the Shidduch crisis is not because they don't allow mixed dancing. Because in the Upper West Side, they allow a lot worse than mixed dancing. And there's still a Shidduch problem. Okay? It is not the problem that boys aren't meeting girls. Or girls aren't meeting boys on the Upper West Side. Okay, anybody who knows, again, you can rewrite history any way you want, but the current history of what goes on there, what goes on the Upper West Side, not for everybody, but a good portion of people, right, is not because they are not having an opportunity to meet the opposite sex. It's because the opportunity is so easy, they don't need to get married. That's part of the problem. And again, that is a fact. That is not my idea. I would wish it wouldn't be like that. There are people who go, just to make it, right, there's what is known in those areas, right, as a tefillin date.
A what?
Tefillin date. That means that you take your tefillin along because you plan to be there in the morning. No, I just made it up. I do. Yes. Yeah, yes. Yes. So, again, you can look at the world through rosy glasses. Right? I love Young Israel. I was a Young Israel rabbi. They paid me. I made my living from them. I'm nothing against the Young Israel movement. Right? But it's true that that was a fault. A lot of things have faults. This was one of the faults, and they got rid of it. They voted. There was a time when it was a very big, what? They encouraged it and they held it was l'shem shamayim, that they're doing a service to Klal Yisrael. And exactly for the reason you said, what you said is 100%. So what's wrong with that? Okay, give me three more minutes, I'll tell you what's wrong with that. What's wrong with the conservative? The conservative, some of them, not all of them, but some of the leaders were very knowledgeable people and they really meant well. What was wrong? And you see what came from that. The Young Israel had the sense of changing it, of stopping it. And at the behest of Gedolei Israel, because there were Young Israel leaders who then became under the influence of Gedolim, like Rav Aaron Cutler or whatever, right? Bunim or whatever. And they were leaders in Young Israel. And they also were known to Gedolei Yisrael, and they eventually overturned this idea. Okay, I just read a book on my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Gifter. Rabbi Gifter was a part-time rabbi in the Young Israel in Cleveland in the early years. And in there's a story about Rav Gifter speaking to what's called the board of the shul and telling them that it's usher to have mixed dancing. And they said, Rabbi, I'm sorry, but that's not your business. Okay? And one of them, who was Choshava Yid, I think it was one of the Spiros, said, it is the rabbi's business, and if the rabbi said, we can't do it, we can't do it, and that's the end. And they stopped doing it in Cleveland. But
it never started in Detroit.
Okay, you're then Adaraba in Detroit, there was something special. But in the major, in the national dinner of Young Israel, up until, I don't know, maybe the 50s even, even after that, the national dinner included mixed dancing. It was part of the agenda of the organization. Okay, in any case, that's not to say anything bad about Young Israel. They stopped it. But it took a time, and the reason they started it was for exactly what you said. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? The Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says the following marshal, and we'll end with this. He says there were once two kings, King Reuven and King Shimon. And King Reuven said to King Shimon, I'll bet you $1 million that I can get your prime minister to undress publicly. King Shimon said, no way in the world. This man is a respectable man. There's no way you can get him to dress publicly for nothing. He said, okay, I'll bet you $1 million I can. If I can, you give me a week. If in a week I can do it, you give me $1 million. If I can't, I'll give you $1 million. The conditions of the bet were he could tell him anything, just can't tell him about the bet. So he calls him in and he says, look, I'm sending you to King Reuven's land for a week. I want you to promise me one thing. That's all. You will not undress publicly there. He said, that's all you want from me? No problem. You got it. He goes to King Reuven's land. He's there for a day or two. King Reuven calls him in. He says, I've been observing you. And you are one of the most adept statesmen I've ever seen. And it really amazes me that a hunchback like you could be such an adept statesman. The guy says, hunchback? I'm not a hunchback. He says, yeah, of course you're a hunchback. He said, don't get insulted. I still think you're in a very, very fine statesman, despite the fact that you're a hunchback. He says, I'm not a hunchback. He says, you are a hunchback. He said, I'm so sure you're a hunchback, I'll bet you $500,000 that you're a hunchback. He says, $500,000? This is ridiculous. I know I'm not a hunchback. I'm going to win $500,000. He said, well, how do I prove it? He says, only one way. I will call my entire court in, and you will get undressed in front of them. And they will see if you're a hunchback or not. If they say you're a hunchback, I win the $500,000. If they say you're not a hunchback, I'll give you $500,000. That's how sure I am. The guy says, it's ridiculous. I know I'm not a hunchback. Nobody in their right mind is going to say I'm a hunchback. Then he remembers the king said that he shouldn't undress publicly. He said, but if the king would know that I could make $500,000, he surely would not be upset. So he gets undressed. They all look and say, this guy's not a hunchback. The guy says, okay, I lose. Here's $500,000. He runs back to the king. He says, before you get upset with me, I know I did what you told me not to do, but here's $500,000. I'll give you half. I get half. Everybody's happy. He says, no, I'm not. If you give me the whole $500,000, you lost me $500,000. Right? You don't think I knew that you could make $500,000? You lost me $1 million. So too, you don't think the Rabbanu Shalom knew that if you permit people to drive on Shabbos, more people will come to shul? You don't think that God knew that if he permitted people to mix dance, that there'd be more shidduchim, right? And still God said, that is not a reason to say that it's okay. It's still prohibited. That means that God sees the $1 million loss, and we see the $500,000 benefit. Don't be fooled by the $500,000 benefit you see, when it may be that what's called promiscuity, mixed dancing is promiscuity, destroys the world more than not having shidduchim. Maybe. I don't know. I can't see in the heavens what's destructive and what's not. All I can go is by what God said. And if God said, you know what? If it's a matter of making shidduchim, let him dance. Let him have tefillin dates, whatever. But if God didn't say that, he didn't say that. What wouldn't happen?
God would never say that.
Yeah, okay. I don't know what God would say. It's up to him. Right? I don't really tell him what he should say or not. But he never said to us that it's okay to be Mechallel Shabbos to come to shul. He never said to us it's okay to dance if your intention is to bring kids into shul. Never said that. That's not an exception to the rule. If it would be an exception, God did say, when it's a matter of life and death, you're allowed to be Mechallel Shabbos. That God did say. So I know that if I'm Mechallel Shabbos to take somebody to the hospital because his life is in danger, it's okay. But not if to take somebody on Shabbos to shul. God didn't say that. So therefore, where it appears like I'm doing something against what the Rebbe Shlom said, but I'm doing it for a good reason, remember that your good reason may see the $500,000 benefit, but there's a $1 million loss that you don't see.